The contrarians are super excited to be partnering with Hewison Private Wealth. I've known Andrew, who runs Hewison, for many years, and they're among the best in the business and have been providing high-level wealth management for almost 40 years. Hewison are different from so many cookie-cutter wealth managers out there and are not affiliated or owned by any of the big banks. Hewison is independently owned by the partners of the firm and pride themselves on being able to provide long-term bespoke strategies for their client base. Hewison advisors take the time to get to know and understand their clients and help them create individually tailored portfolios across a range of asset classes. Working with Hewison is a bit like flying business class. Their advisors work with a really small client set to ensure you receive the best possible service with clients like business owners, executives, and tech founders. So if you've got a minimum of $1.5 million in investable assets and in wanting to upgrade your wealth management, exclusive to contrarians, Hewison are offering a free 30-minute discovery call to see if they're the right partner for you. To speak to the experts at Hewison, give them a call on 03-8548-4800 or go to hewison.com.au/contrarians.
I looked at that show and I thought the relationship between that older brother and younger sister, which is like I've got kids with the same relationship age-wise, my kids' relationship is very similar to that more broadly. And I thought those are great role models for young siblings. That's what I really liked.
And this is Charlie and Lola, I'm imagining you're talking about now.
Yes, that's correct. Peppa Pig, I mean, I find less affinity with pigs.
Yeah, and Peppa Pig's
and
just
Peppa speaking Pig's barnyard just animals.
Peppa's just a... Just,
there's too much...
Peppa's a terrible character. She's just a bit like Veruca Salt from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She's just a disgusting character. And that makes the dad sound like a moron and the anyway, like it's a... There's real issues with Peppa. But anyway. Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir, the only pod that takes you behind the scenes and gives you the inside word on the world of tech and growth from the insiders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of Luxury Escapes, journalist and angel investor. And I'm joined by my great mate, Adir Schiffman, executive chairman of Catapult Sports and serial investor. In today's episode, we're talking about the Bluey business juggernaut, Tesla's profit slump, Atlassian's great results while its founder exits, and have we seen peak diamond? And we're back, episode 38. Adir, welcome. Good to see you again.
The highlight of every episode for me is you trying to figure out what number we're up to.
Fumbling away, looking at what last week's was. We're getting so many now. It actually gets harder as we get. When it was number three, it was pretty easy.
I think you'll find they increase by approximately one per week. I think that's how it works.
How was, speaking of week 30, your 38th week, how was it? Do you have a busy week?
How was my 38th week? I have a very nice and somewhat uneventful week. You know, it's Passover for the Jews, as you would know. So
I do.
This every Jewish festival somehow involves ruining my diet. I don't mean that I'm on a diet. I mean just my general day-to-day diet. This one wiping out anything to do with grains of any sort. Other than the worst crackers ever invented in probably 8,000 years of human history. So I've been struggling through that. I presume you've got some similar problems.
I know, but one of our co-founders, a guy called Josh, who lives in New York now, his wife is in sort of cordon bleu style chef, and she now runs, they both run together, multiple gluten-free bakeries across the US. There's two in New York, one in LA. They do e-commerce delivery. They're incredible. I'm not gluten-free, but their food is so good, it actually wouldn't make me turn gluten-free. That's the best bagel I've ever eaten in my life, is the bagel I had at.
You can't turn gluten-free because gluten is the last actual nutritional item that you consume.
Potentially so, but
that's all you've got left.
But yeah.
You know, in Chinese cuisine, you can actually buy bags of gluten. Like, I'm not joking. There's actually this, they extract the gluten from the wheat and there's these balls and they use them like in their cooking. Yeah. And the first time I saw it, I just couldn't believe it. Gluten balls.
Do you remember in the 80s, like restaurants would have these big signs, no MSG? It was like this fat lie. For some reason, I don't know, you're the doctor. Why was MSG, if anything, just salt? Why was MSG so frowned upon in the 80s?
It's not good. It's not good for you at all, but it does. What's amazing about MSG is, you know, you've got, I'm going to be a bit rusty in saying this, but you've got a certain number of receptors on your tongue, which are like sweet, salty, I don't know, bitter, I think is one.
Sour.
Let's say sour. There's some water. And then there's this one receptor
Unami.
With a Japanese name. Umami. You've got it. Yes.
And cheese.
And that is this receptor that only MSG triggers this receptor of umami.
Yeah.
And that is why it's so popular in cooking.
I love umami.
I think it is possible. I mean, hopefully I won't be quoted on this because I just want to preface this by saying I'm not sure I entirely know what I'm talking about, but it is possible that the whole MSG, like anti-MSG campaign, it may have been flawed, and it's possible that MSG isn't actually bad for you. I have some vague recollection that the whole thing was discredited.
Now. Yeah, I think it's fine now. I think you never see these.
Well, anything bad is good.
Anything from the 80s is probably wrong. Fashion, like Discman, most things from the 80s we realised were foolish in hindsight.
You think a Discman was bad?
I hated Discman. They're too bulky.
Really?
Yeah.
Too bulky compared to what? The stereo in your house at the time, there was no streaming. Well, compared to,
they took over from Walkman. Remember, they were the successor of Walkmans. They weren't before Walkman.
No, I understand how it works. And so you had something that where you had, if you had tapes, you could play them on the go.
Yeah.
And then you could play CDs on the go. And then they worked out how to make it so that it remembered some of it, right? So if it jumped, it wouldn't skip.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that you're looking at the past with very harsh glasses. They were those big innovations back then.
Anyway, back to my original point, which was the gluten-free bakeries that my co-founder Josh ran. Anyway, so obviously Jewish people on Passover can't have leavened wheat, essentially.
5 grains.
Yeah.
I'm going to correct you and say 5 grains. Wheat, barley, rye, spelt, oats.
Well, funnily enough, there's a sect of, this is not a religious show, but I think some of that stuff is now acceptable for, like, certainly certain types of Jews can have that
stuff. None of that stuff is, yes. You know who that stuff is acceptable for? I'll tell you. Christians. None of that stuff is acceptable for Jews. But you're thinking of other stuff. We won't get into it. But none of that stuff is acceptable. That's a different thing.
But the gluten-free industry now is making hay in Passover because you can basically have bread-like stuff.
Hay. You can eat hay on Passover.
Well, because these gluten-free bakeries are now so good, you can basically have, they basically make bread. It kind of makes a mockery of this whole thing. They can, of course, the Jews have found a loophole around their own laws with this gluten-free industry now. So it's, you can basically just get around Passover, even if you're quite orthodox, which is an interesting phenomenon.
I did notice that in Melbourne, there were the gluten-free bakery nearish to where I live was completely overflowing with people for that exact reason. So who knows? This is called the law of unintended consequences.
And so there's so much business news happening this week. We didn't know where to sort of limit it down to. But I think one of the biggest stories we saw was the BHP Anglo-American takeover, probably one of the biggest takeovers from Australia, probably would be the biggest Australian takeover in history if it goes through. There's many, many things that could go wrong between now and whenever it sort of does proceed. But what were your thoughts on that?
So I'm not ultra sophisticated in the mining in resources industry. It's probably one of my areas of weakness, to be honest. But I did take a look at this because I was intrigued because it's so big. It's like a $40 billion offer. You know, it's ultra complicated, this offer. Like in order, this offer is basically BHP offering to buy Anglo American. Those are two huge competitors. It's all stock-based, the offer. There's no cash whatsoever. It's contingent on Anglo American selling two divisions of their business that effectively account for one-third of their revenue.
That's African business,
essentially. So there are, like, yeah, and, like, so this is not a simple process, right? It's like you have to nail every single part of this simultaneously in order for this transaction to actually occur. But I thought there was one very interesting kind of adjacent to this transaction that was reported, which it turns out, I didn't know this, Anglo American owns the De Beers business, the diamond business.
Yeah, they have for many years.
Had a monopoly for a very long time.
And there was some sort of cross shareholding. I think Cecil Rhodes was, I think, didn't find De Beers. There's this whole sordid history of De Beers because it's all blood diamonds and all this stuff. And they ran this legalized monopoly over diamonds where they controlled the price of diamonds. Eventually got broken only in the last sort of 20 years by a combination of Russian diamonds and some other diamonds that sort of came out of Africa that weren't part of that. They sort of ran this closed shop for diamonds. They controlled the supply and the demand for diamonds, essentially. So it was a fascinating case study in business. And
there are stories about diamond merchants, and they would just get a bag of diamonds from De Beers for a certain amount of money. And the bag was a little felt bag that had diamonds in it. And they couldn't even choose which diamonds they wanted. and you just took them out and saw what you got. And if you complained, you just wouldn't get any diamonds next year.
Yeah. And I think it was De Beers that effectively, so diamonds pre, and I think it was about the 1940s, probably just post-war, where diamonds weren't really that much of a thing. De Beers essentially created the wedding ring, sorry, the engagement ring industry for diamonds. It was an unbelievable marketing achievement to do that.
I totally agree. One of the greatest marketing, I wouldn't even call it campaigns, one of the greatest sustained marketing efforts to position a product. It was a product in search of a market, and they basically created a market.
And I think it was
With the whole Diamonds Are Forever campaign.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was the Oppenheimer. I think it was Ernest Oppenheimer. There was a series of Oppenheimers. And they eventually did a hookup with Anglo, which was this UK South African mining company. And it just, I don't follow the mining sector much at all. But when I was a paralegal at a law firm called Freehills, this is my university job. My job was essentially to write, and it was such a weird job, but there was a mining partner at Freehills, who I somehow got a job with, and my job was to write this weekly update on the mining industry. So I was a business journalist back when I was 20. I didn't really know what I was talking about. I basically went go through all the articles. I'd get this dump of every article on mining in Australia, and I'd strictly summarise the stories I thought was interesting. And it got sent to...
I find that astonishing. That's amazing.
What was most astonishing, people got sent to like the CEOs of all these big mining companies who were reading the summary from this little guy who didn't know what the hell he was talking about. It was...
No, but you're very smart, and also you've got an inquisitive mind. You would have caught on quickly to it. I think that's a remarkable story. I've never really had any direct exposure to this industry. I thought the most interesting thing about the story with respect to De Beers is this. You probably are familiar with what has been happening in the diamond industry over the last 15 years. I'm only familiar with it because I watched a movie called Nothing Is Forever. I saw it on the plane, and it was a fantastic documentary. But you probably know what's been happening in the diamond industry for the last 15 years.
I'm assuming you're talking about manufactured diamonds that are effectively exactly chemically the same as real diamonds, aren't they?
Unbelievably similar. So, you know, when people think about diamonds, you claim to be young, so you may not remember this, but there was something called cubic zirconia.
Absolutely remember this.
Which, you remember that? Presumably they're made of zirconia.
They're still around, I think. I'm pretty sure cubics are still around.
Yeah, probably. And like, you know, there are these businesses like Brett Blundy's business that's Lovisa at the moment. Lovisa, which is, I don't know if they use them. I don't know where they fit exactly. Yeah. But
Pandora, it's basically all that stuff. Ice. Yeah.
Fake diamonds, yeah. Right? And so, but then there was this technological jump where you could really get carbon, graphite, and under pressure you could turn it into diamonds. And it's become so sophisticated, it is certainly indistinguishable to the naked eye. And even with very sophisticated technology, we're talking about a couple of atomic bonds being slightly different to the ones that appear naturally.
Yeah.
And you wonder if that's even consequential or not. And what this documentary said is effectively that probably 10 or 20% of all of the natural diamonds being sold today just have mix-ins of these artificially made diamonds, and they're just flowing around and mixing around. So I think that diamonds have suffered, on the one hand, they've suffered a big loss in prestige in some ways. On the flip side, obviously, LVMH acquired Tiffany's, and they've been working hard with diamonds and jewelry.
And that's been an outstanding acquisition from all reports. I think that basically doubled its sales and significantly increased its profits.
Which is interesting because the most fascinating statistic I read with respect to De Beers... So Anglo is trying to offload De Beers. That's the conversation.
Separately from this whole BHP thing.
Separately.
And BHP used to have a diamond business. I'm not sure they still do. They used to have a Canadian diamond business, from memory. When I wrote that report, I used to always talk about this Canadian diamond business it had. That was one of the things that actually challenged De Beers. It was BHP's... Argyle. No, sorry, that was Rio. Rio had this Argyle diamond business, and that was one of the big challenges.
It was a great business, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure they still have it.
They go and mine in Western Australia. They find discoloured diamonds.
Right. Yeah.
And then they change... I mean, diamonds is... This is an area where, like, this should be the core subjects of marketing at university. They go and find discoloured diamonds and completely shift the narrative that these are pink diamonds that are the rarest diamonds on earth.
Exactly.
And the discoloration becomes an enormous selling point. I think they're pretty much about to run out of Argyle diamonds being mined. I think they're out.
So what you're saying, the bug becomes a feature.
It becomes a very expensive differentiating feature.
Yeah, for a bloke who doesn't know much about the mining industry, you know a lot about diamonds.
Yeah, well, you know, my level of superficial knowledge at a veneer level is pretty impressive. When you dig slightly deeper that we get into trouble. So I'll tell you about... So De Beers are trying to offload this thing. Oh, sorry, Anglo is trying to offload De Beers, or they're looking to. What do you think has been the performance of De Beers' revenue in the last 12 months? As a percentage, up, down,
I'm assuming
flat.
It's down for multiple reasons. You've got China, China was just struggling, obviously. So almost every luxury brand has been hit. And then you've got the fake diamond, the fake real diamonds, what do you want to call them? The non-cubic, so the manufactured diamonds. So you'd think there's a sort of maelstrom of bad existential factors impacting this business.
Very impressive. So this plays to your natural strength, which is to be bearish. So yes, it's been down. How much do you think it's down? I mean, it's a very unfair question.
40%.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I think you're directionally right. It's 23%. But like the reason I say directionally right is because it's not 3% or 5%. They're down one quarter in 1 year. And so the question is whether this is just luxury good related, you know, China's weak or whatever, or whether this is some structural change in the way that people feel about diamonds. And so I found this whole thing completely fascinating. Certainly, I mean, you know, everybody I think has caught on to the fact that diamonds are not rare and the resale value of diamonds is terrible compared to the retail price because there's no scarcity factor.
Remember I was speaking to that jeweler at cricket a couple of months ago when he told me how the jewelry industry has like 80% margins at a retail level. And from memory, he was saying, and I think it was him who was telling me, because I was asking about this whole diamond thing, and I think the manufactured diamonds have a terrible resale value, apparently. Apparently they sort of have no resale, whereas real diamonds, I think, do have a pretty good resale, or I don't think it's impacted the resale hugely. So a question for you, given that these manufactured diamonds aren't discernible, would you... And if you're proposing to somebody next week, would you buy a real diamond or a manufactured diamond? So you can get probably like a 4-carat manufactured diamond for the price of a 1-carat real one. What would you get?
It's a good question. So the guy on this show, the documentary I was talking about, is the most advanced, sophisticated scientist, he's some kind of geoscientist who's manufacturing these diamonds. They are indiscernible from diamonds. And he gave one to his fiance when he proposed to her and told her that it was fake. And he said she was very unhappy about it. But the reason that she was unhappy is she just wanted a bigger one. It wasn't to do with the... So I think that my natural inclination would be... I mean, you're asking me if I kind of... A personal question that I'm happy to answer, but it would be, I would look for something that has some sentimental value or is special in some way, as opposed to fixating on whether it's a diamond or not, or real or fake. That would be my personal disposition. I don't think the nature of the stone would be especially important to me.
I think this is the classic, diamonds have become now, as in real diamonds, have become a classic luxury good, inverted commas luxury. So you've now got, we're not talking Hermes bag, which arguably has some functionality and whatever, last year for life, as well as the luxury nature. You've got two virtually identical products, the human eye. One is 10x the cost. The only justification is real diamonds have some sort of brand and manufactured diamonds don't. It's hard to determine any other difference.
So let me tell you this story to finish off this chat about gemstones. So, you know, I told you that I read the autobiography of Jerry Weintraub, who was a big shot producer.
Yes.
He produced
Ocean's 11,
12, 13, some other stuff, right? So my recollection in this book is that Jerry's dad, one of the things he did was he sold these gemstones, semi-precious gemstones, and he found some gemstone that was semi-precious and huge and not worth an especially large amount of money, and crafted a whole narrative around it, calling it like the princess of whatever gemstone and like sent it on tour and ended up selling for this enormous amount of money. because of the narrative that he created around it. And you and I talk about narratives like quite a lot and the importance of narratives in business. And I think that this industry, perhaps more than any other, maybe the art industry is heavily dependent on narratives as well. And what do they call it in art? Like where the, who had the art and where it came from and who owned it?
It's called Providence, I think.
Exactly. You're right. Providence. And so, you know, you need a narrative because when you look at a piece of art, it's not obvious at all why it should cost like $5 million versus like $500. Yep. And so I think that those industries, these ultra luxury industries where it's just art and the appreciation of objects, narratives are very central to the success of these industries.
Well, it goes back to the De Beers original. De Beers, and obviously De Beers is a business that struggled, a $7 billion business now, was multiples of that. But that narrative it created in the 40s has managed to survive. And it's even in a way survived manufactured diamonds. It's still, people still pay a premium for real ones. I just want to go into another story, which I thought is a business that's been we've talked about many times on the show, an Atlassian. And they had they announced their quarterly results last week and had in many ways, a really good quarter. Their revenue was up 30-odd% year on year. They continued to move across to subscription-based revenues from server-based revenues. Their costs were up a little bit stable, but so R&D.
Did they get new customers? That was your criticism last time, is that the revenue was just price increasing.
So the G&A was down. So they've taken, for the first time, I think, in a long time, so they're spending less money.
Cost cutting.
And marketing and sales was basically steady year on year. So again, probably down significantly that quarter. So they essentially everything we told them to do, I'm sure Mike and Scott listen to the show religiously and love what we say and take everything on board because they did exactly what we said. They cut costs and their revenue was up. So one thing, as you just said, one thing I've been hot on is that they haven't been increasing customers by anywhere near what they've increased revenue. So their revenue came from what we call expansion revenue, which is customers spending more as an existing customer. Yep. If you look at the queue, now they only break up large customers, which again is a bit suspicious. They've changed that metric, but it's what we have. The number of large customers increased about 1,500 from 42,000, basically 43,000 to 44,500. So that is,
hold on. 2.5%.
2.5%. So not terrible in a quarter, not amazing, but clearly nowhere near as much as their revenue is growing, but not, it's probably a slight improvement on the last year equivalent. So on the whole, a pretty good quarter by Atlassian. They delivered a pretty good result. But two things happened. So Scott Farquhar, their co-founder, as forecast by one Adir Schiffman, literally 4 months ago, you couldn't have predicted this any better. He has resigned, and basically completely so. He's effectively out, but he remains a director, and that's pretty much it. So you have absolutely, I don't think that was an official prediction from you last year, but it should have been, because that is about as much of a bullseye as one can get. So Mike's still around, but Scott's gone. And the market, you'd think the market would have reacted well. This is a quarter that really delivered, Atlassian delivered pretty much everything we could have asked of them. Good revenue growth and cost control. And the market absolutely hated it. It was down about 8%, I think, last week. Or basically just after the news.
Like Scott leaving? Do you think that's what it was? Because you are Mr. Bear Case on founders leaving a business. How do you feel about one of the founders leaving in terms of prospects of this business?
Sorry, down 10% the day after. You've got one founder still there, so I think it's not as if they both left, and I'm not sure how much Scott and Mike still work in the business. I did find it a bit amusing that the reason Scott gave for wanting to quit was he wanted to spend more time with family. And this is a guy who basically never goes to the office. He works from home every day. So I'm not sure he could possibly physically spend more time with family than he does already, but that was the reason he gave. I think he probably just had enough. If you remember back in January, I gave my bear case for Atlassian. I said, I think they're overpriced. Obviously incredible business, but overpriced. What do you reckon the share price has dropped since then?
Well, I mean,
3 months.
Your call is right. 3 months, it could be 30%.
29.81%. So you're pretty close.
I can't believe I've said 30%. And just so you wouldn't give me the win, you've gone to two decimal places where I was 0.19% off the perfect number. That is very rough.
Well, you were very close. I'll give you that. And that's another win for the Contrarians hedge fund, I think. So if you're a hedge, so 30% annualized in 3 months is a pretty good return. So hopefully some hedge funds that trade on the Contrarian show. I think there's many out there cleaning up, I think. So this is interesting. So I think this goes to my comments back in January. So Atlassian have done everything we could have asked them, and they've had a great quarter. And I think the reason the market hated it wasn't because Scott left necessarily. Maybe they didn't love that. I think it's because now, and it actually made profit last quarter. It made $12 million, I think, was in net, which is a genuine, like, had heaps, $500 million free cash flow, but we know that's impacted by, obviously, by stock-based compensation and other stuff. But real profit was $12 million. So it actually made some money for the first time in several years. And now it's got the problem. It's actually got to make real money now. So if you're trading on a $80 billion Australian valuation, that's a business that probably, and growing it, let's say the growth rate sort of normalizes at 20%, that's probably an EBITDA multiple or a net profit multiple of maybe you can get 40 or 30 or 40. It's got to make $1.5 billion a year to justify this valuation. It's making $12 million. I think investors have now gotten realistic. I think you can no longer get revenue multiples when you start making money again. It's starting to make money again. And I think investors go, hold on, I don't think this business can make $1 billion a year.
Well, that's it. I mean, I remember when we had this conversation, the universal position we both reached was there is no possibility of them making enough money to justify this share price. And I think that's the problem that they fundamentally have. My recollection is their revenue was $4 billion a year approximately, and now they've grown 30%. So let's say maybe they're going to do $5.5 billion or $6 billion. Even if they're doing,
well, they did exactly a billion in the last quarter, almost exactly.
Okay, so $4 billion a year. Yep. Okay, and so even if they keep 25% of that, that's a bill. Even if they keep 40%, that's a bit over $1.5 billion. It's tough to justify a share price unless you're growing like a rocket. Now, maybe if they were doing those numbers and growing like a rocket, you'd say they're pretty expensive, but they're not shortable. But the problem is they were never going to be able to get there. The question is this. This is my view. Like, I'm sure you saw this. This week is the week that Alphabet started paying dividends. Yeah. Did you see
that? Saw that. First time ever, wasn't it?
First time ever. And they said they're going to keep doing it. It's not a one-off. And so Alphabet's now gone to dividends. You know, what we're seeing is there's been this historical narrative that the ASX loves dividends, but in the US they don't pay dividends. They keep them. But now we're seeing dividends being paid. And so, you know, I think that the world is after like 10 years of, you know, zero interest rates, the world is returning to the idea that one of the defining hallmarks of a business is that it makes money and ultimately, ideally, gives that money back to its owners. And so I think the world is shifting back to that historical view of a business.
Yeah. And I think Australia has always been a bit more rational than the US, like in terms of, like, most businesses in Australia, other than a small cohort of sort of Canva type businesses, generally it's hard not to be on an EBITDA multiple in Australia. And we actually saw it with our good friends at Kogan, who delivered a great result. They made their revenue was down, but that was intentional. They made really nice profit and the market hated it because it's now, well, actually in a different sense. It didn't make enough profit according to the market and its revenue dropped, even though that's exactly what they wanted, what they said they were going to do. So it's really hard to impress Australian shareholders, I think.
It is. And I'll say it's like, you know, someone obviously involved in a, you know, SaaS business, global SaaS business listed in Australia. There is a strong argument for reinvesting profitability if these are my kind of requirements for reinvesting profits in a SaaS business. You need to have like really good unit economics, like really high gross margins, and ideally really high contribution margins. You need to be growing revenue strongly and you need to have low churn. And if you've got those three characteristics, it makes sense to keep investing in growth. And one of the challenges is I think that's harder to persuade on the ASX investors than it is in the US. But notwithstanding that, yeah, generally it is pretty sensible to say how much money is this business making and therefore let's try and value it on that basis.
That's a good point. I've got to go another quick story, which was the US effectively banning non-competes, which we've talked about on the show a few times. Are they a bit futile anyway? Matt Levine, who writes a great column for Bloomberg, essentially said the second order effect of this means no more gardening leave. So you have investment bankers around the world devastated. They're not being paid to do nothing for 6 months when they change jobs. So what was your view? Is this an impactful change or is it a bit of a storm in a teacup? They were never enforceable anyway, so who cares?
Well, you know, the US is like, not, it's not like Australia for non-competes. For example, like, waiters in a cafe sign non-competes that they can't work in another cafe within 25 miles for 2 years if they stop working. So, like, it is, that's, by the way, that's not, I'm not exaggerating with that example. These are real examples. And so they seem to me, I would describe them as having, you know, run out of control in the US. There's definitely need to pull them back. Like, you can't do that to people and stop just regular workers from 100%. Earning a living. Like, yeah. I got to work in a cafe and then I leave and then I got to move to another town to get another job in a cafe. Yeah. Like, it's ridiculous. So I do think it's good that they wiped that out. However, the flip side is this. Obviously, if we talk about Australia, it's difficult. Before I talk about Australia, let me tell you, in the US, I once had a situation where I employed someone from a company that I didn't really consider a competitor, and it was quite a senior executive, but they decided they were going to make a big issue about it. And ultimately, I brought in Mark Cuban's lawyers as my lawyers. It was very expensive. I mean, the US, I mean, if you think Australia is expensive for legal fees, the US is like a multiple of that. And ultimately, we went backwards and forwards and solved the problem. But it was an expensive headache to go through. And, you know, these are often enforced very aggressively in the US. So I don't think it's directionally a bad thing for most jobs in the US. In Australia, my experience with it is that they tend to be hard to enforce. But there have been situations where I've paid someone and I've said, you're signing a non-compete. Your salary is X. This extra 15% I'm paying you every year on top of X is specifically you acknowledging that I'm paying you for this non-compete when you finish. Or I say in the non-compete, there's a one-year non-compete, because, you know, the way that works in Australia, for people not familiar with the contracts, is it's generally a cascading non-compete. Yeah. So you start off by saying, you can't compete anywhere under any circumstances forever, and then you cascade down geographically.
It's usually after 2 years.
I know. I'm being facetious, but then you cascade down the geography. So maybe you start globally, then Australia, then Victoria, then Melbourne, then whatever. And then and you cascade down the time. And the idea is that if the court says, you know, 2 years is not acceptable, they can step down and they can stop at 6 months if they want. And so I've had situations where I think the best way to have a non-compete is it needs to be a senior executive. It's someone that you know has very detailed information on how your business is competitively differentiated and the advantages it has over competitors, and you build in a mechanism where you pay them for the time that they're not competing. And so I would build in and say, if you leave, like, we've got the option for 1 year to pay you, you know, your salary.
Gardening leave is what that's called.
Yeah, gardening leave. Yeah, and I think that's totally legitimate in my view. But I think the idea of not paying people is illegitimate. And I think the idea of, like, anyone but senior executives being subject to a non-compete, unless there's special circumstances, intellectual property, or product person, I think is also ridiculous. It's too prohibitive on people earning a living. What's been your experiences?
I think we've talked about my experience and how they're so unenforceable. I'm less bothered about that they have to be just senior. I'm actually, if somebody wants to leave, I actually don't mind if they leave. Generally, depends where they go to, but in most cases, unless it's like sort of a really, really direct competitor. But the thing that I don't like is when they take clients. So they've built a relationship because of us and because of the relationship they've built. We're actually confidential information, really, which is covered separately, but they sort of merge into one. If someone steals clients, or they steal...
Like hotel relationships.
Yeah, in our case, hotel relationships. But it could be any obviously different businesses that have different relationships. In our case, it's probably the most likely is hotel relationships. They do that, or if they take co-workers, because they met this co-worker because of Luxury Escapes, they know this person because of Luxury Escapes, and as a result of that, they take people. So those two things I really don't like. But otherwise, I actually don't mind. If somebody wants to go, so be it. They go.
I consider both of those behaviours immoral and unethical. That's my view on those behaviours. I don't think this is not business is business. This is immoral and unethical to do that.
And by the same token, when somebody comes to us, they say, I'm going to bring my colleagues with me. We'll say, no, I don't think so. We don't want to get people that way either. If somebody comes to, if somebody's leaving and comes to us, that's probably, it's a bit of, it's a bit grey, but it's a bit different. But we don't want to see people do the same in reverse. And it's something that we frown upon.
Do you know?
Absolutely.
Do you know how often I've been offered competitive information, confidential financials of competitors in the market by people trying to ingratiate themselves to me? I've always said no to it. Yep. I don't want any part of that. But I would. It's not infrequent that people do that.
Huh. I don't think I've ever been offered that.
Really? No. Yeah, like it might be that someone had a deck they put together for doing a capital raising that had their financials in it, or it might be someone put some financials in their own deck to do something, and I'm like, I don't want any part of this. Like, the information that you're offering me, it is not ethical for you to be sharing this information with me. And I think, like, I can win in the marketplace fair and square, and I can play tough, but I don't want to play with that kind of cheating or that kind of, like, you know, immorality.
No question, how beneficial, even if you knew it, how much would it even change the decision you made?
Well, that's the truth, is that mostly it's just like kind of interesting to know for gossip and just satisfying curiosity reasons. You know, the great Leonard Hammersfeld, who obviously runs Buzz.
I think we're trying to, he should be coming on the show at some point.
Few weeks.
When he returns?
He will in the next few weeks. Yeah. So he once had an employee leave and go somewhere to do the exact same thing. And I said to Leonard, aren't you furious about this? And he said to me, oh, my attitude is, if he didn't make it work with us, then I'm not really worried about him making it work somewhere else. And if he makes it work somewhere else, then the problem was us, not him. And so I'm relaxed about it. He's the most easygoing guy I've ever met with respect to just not getting angry about things like that. Whereas I have to admit, I am historically much more of a, just to not specifically quote, I think George W. Bush said this, so I don't want to quote him specifically, but like I do think I am a you're a with me or against me kind of person in business. And if you leave and go to a competitor, I don't hate you as an individual, but I feel like you're on the side of the enemy now. And so I definitely feel that quite strongly.
I think for us there's different, and we consider ourselves almost maybe arrogantly so, sort of a leader in exactly what we do. So that there are other businesses do similar-ish kind of things to us, but we don't sort of consider them equals. There's a booking.com, which is an incredible business and much bigger than us, but we don't, they're not sort of, they're a different type of business. But I'm talking about business a bit more like us. And we've had people who go to those businesses. And my view generally is you're probably making a mistake. And I usually tell someone this if I think they are. And that said, if someone's a really good performer, we almost always welcome them back as long as they leave on good terms and do the right thing.
Sure.
And we've had, I reckon, 20 plus people we call Boomerang who've left and come back. And often from great, really good, my CTO went to Amazon and came back, which was, he sort of left after I took some time off, but which was a great reflection on the business and a great reflection on him. But very regularly we'll have very good people who leave and come back, and we're more than happy for somebody to do, in almost all cases, do that.
Sometimes people that have only worked in one's business, in your business or Catapult or whatever, they don't realize what a great place it is to work. And they need to go elsewhere and see that not everything feels like this and not all leaders care about their staff like this. And it's not purpose-driven everywhere else like it is here. And they need to come back and see that and feel that. I completely agree with you about that. Like, you know, like I've also had had that experience like quite frequently in that situation. And like with Catapult, because, you know, as you said, with Luxury Escapes, Catapult is so much bigger than almost every other player in its industry. And so poaching people from Catapult and promoting them a couple of levels in roles above where they were at Catapult, we can't compete with that. If you go and get someone for sales and say, we're going to make you like the global head of sales at our startup, what the hell can Catapult do to keep you, right? Like, you probably need to go and experience that for your own professional development. And if it works out, then, you know, it works out. And if it doesn't, then come back and we'll find another role for you. You got new experience. So, you know, I think that, I'm not you're with me or against me in that situation, but definitely if someone leaves and then poaches a couple of staff from Catapult, like, that to me is like, it's that's an irredeemable sin.
Well, in a sense, I consider that really theft in some ways. If you use the information you obtained in your employment and you've used it for someone else. So that's very, like, but we've had most of the people who have left, I can't really recall. Oh, there's been one or two, but it's very rare where that's happened, where someone's left and sort of poached people, or indirectly poached people. It's high. And to an extent, if people leave, like, there's a couple of circumstances where people leave, and there's, it might be a category where someone's just been paid a lot more money elsewhere, and that could be because we've mistakenly mispriced them, or the other business is paying overs, more likely the second, very occasionally the first. And if it's the first, that's on us. That's our fault for not being quick enough to recognise someone's ability, and we've failed there. And there's the case where, and the classic case of this is Blake Hutchinson, our great friend, who got a CEO role at Flipper, and he left with our best wishes because it's such a great role. We can't match a CEO role.
That's right.
And he's done incredibly well.
That's right.
Unbelievable. And we take a bit of credit for that. He's working with great people in Walshy and Mark Arbottle, and that's a fantastic story. So there's some really happy.
That's
endings.
Professional development. And people who go and become CEOs, they've had to do non-CEO jobs as they've worked their way up. And part of the reason he is such a good CEO is because what he learned at Luxury Escapes.
Well, I like to take credit. I don't think I can. I don't know how much I can. But
you can take some credit for, like,
he was a great founder before he worked with us. So that was just a really, obviously it was sad for us to lose him, but we're very happy. We were and remain extremely happy for him, for how well him and Flipper have done in the 3 or 4 years, 4 years since. 5 years since.
I'm sure he made you better and the organization made him better. And some of the things that he learned, he's taken with him to Flipper. Like, that is, you know, that's how business should work. I'll tell you this last story before we move on. Like, so I had this bizarre situation one time in Europe where a number of staff came across to join us from another company that wasn't a competitor of ours, but was broadly in the same industry and substantially larger than us. And it was coincidental. Like, they literally, I think, like, we put job ads out and they basically had applied for them, and they weren't poaching each other. It was just coincidence. And I got this reach out from the person running that business at the time that said, can we have a meeting? And so I got on a Zoom call or some video conference or something with the leader there, the CEO, I think it was, or the chairman or whatever it was. And it was this person flanked by two other people and me, who effectively said, you need to stop poaching our staff. And I said to him, but I mean, it was much longer than one sentence. It was not quite a tirade, but directionally a tirade. And my answer to him, I said, I've got two responses to this. The first thing is that what you're requesting is unlawful, and I'm not going to be any part of anything that tries to establish some secret agreement that we're not poaching staff from each other, because that's against the law, and I think it should be against the law, is my view of that.
That's called a keep off the grass deal.
Is that? Yeah, okay. I didn't use that particular term, but definitely I wanted him off any grass that I had, absolutely. But his staff and my staff, that's fine. The second thing I said is this. I said to him, I'm not the person you should be speaking to about this. Go and talk to your staff, because something that is happening in your organization is making people want to leave and come to us. And the solution to your problems is inside your own four walls, not inside our four walls. And that's the last I ever, I didn't think it didn't take it particularly well, but that was the last I ever heard about it. And obviously we never agreed to anything like that. But that I was completely being honest about how I felt about that situation.
I think the caveat there would be, and this obviously wasn't, this yours was just an unusual coincidence, but if you hire one person, they then go bang, 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 and just start reeling off other people in the business. That's a little bit different.
Yes, so I'm not supportive of that.
So in that case, that other CEO, whilst probably not operating fully legally, may have thought that's what happened. And it's not what happened, but that's
right.
Not what
it's
thought.
Possible. But it wasn't coincidental. Like, you called it a coincidence. It wasn't a coincidence. It was clearly that there was some issue going on at this organization and people wanted to leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were a really good option to go to.
Yeah, I'm not denying that, but I'm saying the corollary to that is sometimes that the first organization is actually fine, but somebody's got in everybody's ear and said, come over here, it's much better to work right here. And they've used that conversation.
Well, I did assure him that that was not what was happening. Yeah. And let's clarify, they were not working for me directly, because as you know, I have no employees personally. But yeah, like, so I think, you know, these are complex issues. And generally, I think non-competes used sparingly and in fair ways are appropriate. But generally, people should have freedom of movement between businesses.
I agree. And we'll move on. Super quick break and back in 40 seconds with our next really interesting story on one of Australia's most successful exports that never was. Adir, are you a big time real estate investor?
I'm not. I think I'm probably, unfortunately, it's probably a weaker area for me. And I don't think I've got much sophistication at all in terms of understanding how to put together like a diversified property portfolio.
I think that's really a really good point. I think most people, I think because people might buy a house, a residential house, they think they know a lot about property, but it's really a lot more complex, especially when you're talking commercial property, industrial property. It's a lot more complex than most people think. And that's where performance property comes in. They're just definitely not your average property specialist. They've actually got a dedicated corporate real estate division. And the performance property team step in as the head of property role for their clients, really.
Okay, that sounds interesting. So effectively, it means when you want to make an investment in a diversified property portfolio, you would contact them and they would take the decision-making off your hands, presumably loop you in on the decision-making because ultimately it's going to be me paying for it. But I get to leverage their expertise as if they're almost an in-house advisor for me putting together the portfolio.
Yeah, exactly right. They basically give you an in-house head of property and they do things like review land tax valuations. They navigate lease negotiations. They do all that stuff that really most people don't have a clue on what to do. So whether you own or rent commercial property, Performance Property is the go-to partner for strategic property management. And give Phil Almeida a call at Performance Property on 03-8-539-0300 or go to the website performanceproperty.com.au to see what it's all about. Is on Australia's favourite family, represented in the Bluey cartoon show. And the Bluey juggernaut represents the very best and worst of Australia's commercial successes. The Australian short cartoon last week terrified fans, with many thinking that a 28-minute super episode called The Sign might very well be the last one written by Bluey superstar founder Joe Broom. Just going, Adir, are you a Bluey? Do you know much about Bluey?
I was a bit... My kids were a bit the wrong age. I kind of missed it. I got the Peppa Pigs of this world, but not the Bluey.
Well, actually, Joe Broom, who obviously founded Bluey, wrote for Peppa Pig. So he came from that world. But Bluey has become a phenomenon. Last year, it was the second most streamed television program in the world and easily the most number one kids program, 44 billion minutes streamed. It was beaten by only one show, which had 58 billion minutes. Can you remember what that was? We've talked about it before.
I know which show that was. That was Princess, yes. What's her name show?
Princess,
right?
Megan's show called Suits. That's right. Bluey's value.
I don't think she's called Princess, right?
Maybe she's
called
not. The Duchess. Yeah, she's Duchess. Something. Duchess Megan's show.
The Duchess of Montecito.
Is it Sussex or Cambridge? Which one's she? Sussex. I think she's Sussex. Anyway, the brand is valued at an incredible $2 billion and has somehow accounted for almost a third of Disney Plus's streams last quarter. For those who don't have kids in that age group or haven't seen or heard of it, Bluey is a Brisbane-based TV series created based on a six-year-old blue heeler called Bluey, and Bluey's a girl, her four-year-old sister Bingo, and their parents, Dad Bandit and Mum Chili. And the people who voice Bluey and Bingo are anonymous. Nobody knows who they are. Everyone else is known. Bluey manages to be entertaining for kids as well as adults, which I think is one of its great strengths. Some of the guest stars who have appeared on Bluey include Miff Warhurst, singer Megan Washington, comedic actor Ian McFadyen from Comedy Company, if you remember, and even Lane Beachley has made a guest appearance as a surfy sheepdog. Bluey's creator, Joe Broom, has written every single episode, and he came up with Bluey back in 2010 when he was British kids shows, as we said, like Peppa Pig and Charlie and Lola.
Oh yeah, I know Charlie and Lola. I thought that was a good show. I quite enjoyed watching that with my kids. It was a good, you know what? I looked at that show. You probably won't be interested in what I'm about to say. I looked at that show and I thought the relationship between that older brother and younger sister, which is like I've got kids with the same relationship age-wise, my kids' relationship is very similar to that more broadly. And I thought those are great role models for young siblings. That's what I really liked.
And this is Charlie and Lola, I'm imagining you're talking about now.
Yes, that's correct. Peppa Pig, I mean, I find less affinity with pigs.
Yeah, oh, and Peppa Pig's
and
just
other speaking barnyard animals.
Peppa's just a just,
I don't know. There's too much.
Peppa's a terrible character. She's just an entire bit like Veruca Salt from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She's just a disgusting character, and that makes the dad sound like analogy. A moron. And the anyway, like it's a there's real issues with Peppa. But anyway, ABC funded the Bluey. Clearly, my kids are 7 and 9, so I've grown up in this in the last 10 years, but. In 2016, ABC funded the Bluey pilot, and it aired in 2018 for the first time and quickly became ABC Kids' most popular program. It's unclear exactly how much wealth Joe's made from the show. Some estimate $10 million. I expect there's a lot more than that, given the show's worth $2 billion now. What we do know, though, is that the ABC missed the chance to secure the worldwide commercial rights to Bluey, and it's really vague on how this happened, but according to the ABC itself, both ABC and BBC Studios co-commissioned Bluey with pre-production starting 2017. ABC took the broadcast rights in Australia and BBC somehow got the broadcast and the global commercial rights. The BBC's Director General, effectively their CEO, Tim Davey, told the AFR last year that Bluey was the biggest commercial success for the BBC ever. According to the AFR, BBC makes £5.33 billion of income in 2022 fiscal year. BBC Studios generated £1.63 billion commercially. So that's sort of caused from stuff like Bluey. ABC made $1.14 billion in revenue. Most of that came from government funding. Only $30 million of the ABC revenue came from commercial activity. So sort of a couple of percent of what BBC earns.
So you'd say the BBC, would you say £1.5 billion from commercial revenue?
1.6, yeah.
Which is what?
Call it $3 billion, $3 billion
dollars. Yep. And Bluey is the biggest property they've ever had in history. So one would assume it's also currently the biggest property. And so it may not be most of that $3 billion, but good it could chunk. Be 20% or something of that $3
billion. Yeah, well, if Bluey's a $2 billion business, you'd think, yeah, $500 million plus would be. They've got a huge deal with Moose Toys. I'm not sure if you know Manny
and I do.
Paul,
yeah.
But phenomenal Australian success story. They've done another hit there with Bluey Toys. So yeah, I would say it could be worth $1 billion a year. To BBC. It's
possible.
In Australian dollars.
So have you, so is your soliloquy over? Can I ask you something?
Yeah, all yours.
All right. So why have there not been more questions asked of the ABC about this missed opportunity? Like why was there not like Senate questions, like at Senate estimates about how the ABC, which you know, takes $1 billion a year from Australian taxpayers, how this happened. Now, it may be that it was innocent, or it may be that both ABC and BBC pitched and the founder decided to go with BBC, not ABC. Like, it could be a totally innocent situation where nobody was at fault commercially. But surely this is a question that should be asked and the answer should be into the public domain. Like, we own the ABC. We pay for it. And we should know how they missed the biggest deal in history. Don't you agree? I mean, right.
Yeah, this is a disaster for the ABC. If you look at the ABC's explanation for it, they say BBC is a worldwide business. Joe's worked in the UK before, understood the UK market, wanted a global franchise, and ABC simply couldn't do it. Although, I think that doesn't excuse that they couldn't have had a somewhat smaller stake. Could they have had 30%, 20%, which still would have been huge in the hundreds of million dollars a year. It's given that ABC funded it as well, it feels like this is like not investing in Canberra when you had the opportunity in 2012.
Well, this feels like, well, it's worse than that because like,
yeah, it is worse.
If you didn't invest in Canberra, you didn't have anything to do with it. But like if the ABC commissioned this, it's like you funded Canberra. You took a convertible note, it started to have success, and then you said, I'll take repayment of my money, not shares, you know? Like,
yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's bizarre. And so, as I said to you, like, I'm honestly, not just for the purposes of being nice on this podcast, I'm honestly not jumping to conclusions about that anyone screwed up big time here, but I do think questions should be asked in a setting where, like, the ABC is compelled to answer under privilege. And we should get to the bottom as taxpayers of what happened here, because the ABC is constantly complaining about not having enough money and is constantly demanding more money from the government. And let's say it was $200 million a year, that the ABC could have had as with a minority stake in this. That's 20% of their operating budget. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't have minded that. So, but by the way, personally, we may have not agree on this, but I don't mind the ABC not having infinite amounts of money personally. But I do think it would be nice if we had answers to this particular question. I can't believe how successful this is. It's pretty remarkable.
It's such a... And Joe Broome, who founded it, and basically rewritten every episode, so this is a genuine founder.
I mean, is that crazy? He's written every episode.
How does this guy not... better known. He's created a $2 billion business. I reckon if you asked 1,000 people in Australia who wrote Blue, I don't think anyone would get it right. And he's one of Australia's most successful. He's up there with the Wiggles, I would say, if not even more successful in terms of creating an entertainment powerhouse. And this is basically just him.
He might be happy to not, like, he might detest being in the limelight and have the best of all worlds. Why do you say it's worth $2 billion? Like, what's that number?
That's the number that's expanded around. It must be based on the sort of cash flow, annual cash flows.
But that would imply that its annual profits would be kind of $200 million or $250 million probably.
Probably.
So whatever percentage he has got left, it's not like 1%.
Yeah.
Because if he had, that would be, I mean, it's not even $10 million. Like, it would be half. For him to be worth $10 million, he kept 0.5% of this business. Yeah. It just doesn't seem plausible to me. I don't know if he's on the rich list. I've got no idea. But I suspect he's much, much wealthier.
No, he's not. He's definitely not, but maybe he should be.
That's what I mean. Look, he may not have $650 million.
We might. Like, it's owned by, I think, Lido Studio. I'm not sure if Joe, who owns this Lido Studios business, how much. I don't know the economics of this, actually. It'd be great to get Joe on the show. If we can somehow, maybe you can use your extensive connections and get Joe on the show. But
well, after we've just speculated on his wealth, considering he's a very private guy, I don't think that's the greatest sales pitch to get him on the show. But
well, I don't know if he is private. Maybe he's not private. Maybe just no nobody's thought of how good he is. Yeah, like I think this is a guy who should be recognised as one of the greatest entrepreneurs in Australia at the moment.
He should be next year's Australian of the Year. How about that?
I think there's been a lot worse.
Agree?
Yeah.
Oh, there's been a lot worse. It's the greatest advocacy I've ever heard. No, I think, because you think about Australians of the Year, often they're quite hopeless, right? The choices are not inspired choices.
But here you've got,
there have been some great ones, right? But here you've got a situation where someone, because this is not just a show made in Australia or made by an Australian. It's a show that, like, popularizes Australia and the best parts of Australia.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that is very significant and consequential, that it's taking, like, Australian suburbia to the world. Like, I think there's something quite special about that. So, yeah, I agree with you. He's very unsung or undersung, if there's such a thing.
I totally agree.
I think, how come no one does an ASIC search on what percentage of the company he owns?
Why don't we do that? We'll do it offline.
It costs, like, $30 or something.
Yeah, $30. You know, in the UK, that's free. It's outrageous that we have to pay to do ASIC searches in Australia.
It should be free.
In the UK, you can do a search on anything. It comes in 2 seconds. It's totally free. It's just another
ASIC. I bet it generates tens of millions of dollars for ASIC.
And I think they're trying to sell it. Maybe they even did. I think they're trying to flog it off to pay some of the COVID debt, probably. We pay for our – make people wear masks and also make people pay for ASIC searches. But I was watching
it definitely got deregulated or whatever, open to competition, because when you go online now to do a search, there's a gazillion companies you can do it through.
Yeah, that was years ago. That was like 10 years ago they did that. Just on back to Bluey, I actually watched that. So the sign was that usually it's like a 7-minute episode. This is a big 28-minute episode that freaked everybody out.
Right.
And I actually watched it. The first episode I've really watched properly. My kids love it. They watch a lot of the episodes. And it was actually really good. It was an episode that they were moving from Brisbane somewhere else. They didn't say they were moving to. And how the kids were so sad to be leaving the house. And the reason they moved was because the dad, I think Chili, got a new job somewhere. And the Bluey was saying, we don't want to move, Mum. And Mum's going, we were moving so Dad can get a better job and give you guys a better life. And Bluey goes, I don't want a better life. I want to stay in my house. And it was such a lovely, poignant...
Quite deep, isn't
so
it?
So deep.
I wonder what motivated him to do it. There must have been something special, because he's written an episode that's four times as long as his usual episodes on a very specific theme. I mean, it's clearly this is a thematic that has some meaning. I wonder what is happening or what occurred to make him write this particular thing, whether someone he was close to had this experience and their kids were upset and he thought, this is how I'm going to try and make them more easily cope with the situation. I find that very fascinating that he did that.
I love that line, how you just got the kid to say what the adult didn't, and that we're moving for more money, but I don't want more money. I'm happy with a better life. And so many people get hooked up, get just carried away with, I've got to make more money, I've got to get this better job, I've got to get promoted, I've got to do all this stuff, when is that better? And Bluey is able to properly eloquate what very few adults can and don't think about.
My first question, if we ever got him on this podcast, would be about that episode and what inspired him to write this very special episode, much more than asking him, you know, how much do you earn and how much money and, like, why did the ABC not get a piece? I'm very intrigued to know why he wrote that episode.
Yeah. So fascinating. So congratulations to Joe.
Great story.
It's just a great Australian success story that we're super proud of, and hopefully many more episodes. I know my kids are certainly...
We're super proud, but we had nothing to do with it other than...
Of course, we didn't watch
it. I was going to say born in the same country as him, but I wasn't even that. Other than being proud citizens of the same country, albeit in different cities.
That's about where our contribution ends.
Not that dissimilar to supporting a football team, I would point out.
Exactly. We'll go to one more super quick break and back with our next story on Tesla. Adir, what's your experience been with SEO across all the businesses you've worked with?
Well, I actually had an agency that did SEO at one point in time. And so through that, I was not the SEO guy. And through that, I got some insight into just how complicated and sophisticated SEO is. And since then, I've tried a variety of different people and solutions, and it's a bit of a mix and match for me. I don't have a very sharp answer for you on that.
We're the same. I reckon we've cycled through a dozen agencies before we discovered Portal Ventures. And these guys are the real deal. We've actually used them at Luxury Escapes, and our SEO traffic has jumped dramatically. We also use them at a business called Bookwell, which I used to chair. And the SEO there was so good, we actually were able to sell the business to the global leader almost purely based on how much organic traffic we had from SEO. The guys at Portal Ventures work with some of the best Australian marketplaces and e-commerce businesses, including Flipper, Programmer, Madpaws, Camplify, and AutoGuru. These guys are literally the best of the best. Exclusive to Contrarians listeners, the team at Portal will give you a free 1-hour consultation if you mention Contrarians. To get in touch with Mike and the team, call them on 1300 121 261 or go to www.portal.ventures. And we're back. And for our final story, we have the continued drama at Tesla. And it's almost impossible to read any business newspaper without seeing just a swathe of issues surrounding that electric car maker. Last week, Tesla announced that revenue fell by 9% to US $21.3 billion, short of analyst expectations of $22 billion. To make matters worse, earnings of the EV giant dropped by 55% to only $1.1 billion US for the quarter. Tesla shares actually rallied 10% on the back of Elon Musk previewing a ride-hailing app that will be integrated in Tesla products, further AI investments, and a potential return of Tesla to a more affordable EV. Notwithstanding the slight pop, Tesla shares remain 45% down since Christmas. I think one of our predictions as well was Tesla would drop. So that's a...
Well, that was too obvious though, wasn't it?
Obvious.
That
was awkward. Yeah. I think everything's easy, obviously, in hindsight, but it certainly was obvious at the time. Whilst all this was happening, Tesla's chairwoman, Australia's very own Robin Denham, was, according to Aaron Patrick in the AFR, writing to shareholders, pleading with them to overrule the Delaware Chancery Court and allow the largest executive payment in history, a US $55 billion options grant to Elon Musk, noting that amount's now about $40 billion due to Tesla's share price drop. Denham said in a letter to shareholders, Denham's name was on the letter. I'm not sure she actually wrote this line, but her name's on it. So Denham said, because the Delaware court second-guessed your decision, Elon has not been paid for any of his work for Tesla in the past 6 years that has helped generate significant growth and stockholder value. That strikes us and many of the stockholders from whom we have already heard as fundamentally unfair and inconsistent of the will of stockholders. Aaron Patrick perhaps summed it up best when he noted that Denham could have also written, 2023 was when investors lost confidence in Tesla's ability to keep growing, followed by the judicial condemnation of my leadership. That was certainly pretty straight to the point from Aaron. Adir, I'd love to get your views on, first on Tesla's performance, and then we'll go on to the board's attempt to get Elon back his $55
billion. This is my rapid fire comments on Tesla. One is, I think it's amazing that they made more than $1 billion in the quarter. I know it was down 50% or whatever it was, but if you go back to the very start, this idea, crazy idea, I'm going to build this company. He actually has built a company that makes billions of dollars a year of profit. It's very remarkable, and almost every founder that says, I'm going to do this, they fail. So we have to, I mean, we don't have to do anything, but I would first say it's very impressive that he actually succeeded and achieved this. And it's not news that, like, he's done it and that he's fantastic at business in this, and an innovator. But, you know, it's easy to be negative about this business, in my view. Like, I think this is a business that it's not going to be around in, you know, American ownership or independent ownership in a decade's time and maybe less. But it is amazing what he's
done. So, do you think it will go out of business or just gets bought by someone?
I think the Chinese are a decent chance of buying it at some point. It's just too expensive for anyone to buy now. It's too
would they be allowed? I presume it does go back to sub $100 billion. We'll come back in a second. But would Chinese be allowed to buy?
Yeah, well, that's
Tesla?
That's a separate question. I mean, depends if you think that it has some strategic interest. Personally, I don't think it does have any strategic value to the US in a particular way. Like, it's just an automaker that makes cars that everyone else is making now as well, that has some battery technology that other companies also have. You know, I mean, the Japanese are way behind at the moment, but they'll catch up. And so, yeah, I don't think it's especially strategic. I also think
that's not what guides M&A rule. Like, would the Chinese let GM buy BYD?
You want to rate a democratic elected government in Western civilization and the decisions we would make against the communist PRC? I mean, what does it matter what they would do?
Have you heard of a business called TikTok?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
What's happening there?
Well, they just got banned in the US, didn't they?
And why do you think it got banned?
Yeah. What I'm saying to you is, I think that we need to, unless there's a security or strategic risk, we need to make decisions that are consistent with our set of ethics in the West, and not that match the decision-making structure that the PRC has in China. Because I think,
not sure. I can't see the US allowing China to buy Tesla.
Oh, you're probably right about that, by the way. I don't disagree with that, but you're just saying to me, does it matter? And so it may not. Like, also, almost nothing that gets decided in the US now is being decided on ideology. It's almost entirely being decided on politics. And so that's the truth about the situation. So I think Tesla's impressive in terms of Elon. He did it. Like, he made this business that makes tons of money and revolutionized an entire industry.
And I love the Tesla product. I drive a little Tesla 3.
I don't like it at all.
I love it.
Yeah. It's very uncomfortable and, in my view, poorly made compared to European cars.
I think so. But anyway,
The other point to make, though, is this thing of, like, the business really did not perform too well this quarter, but the share price still popped because Elon can still do the Elon show. And it's like, here's a little explosion over here and a rainbow over there, and this is coming out and that's coming out, and now we're going to compete with Uber. And I can't believe that stuff still goes on. This is why I say you can't short religions. You can't short this. It went up 10% because Elon did the Elon thing, and, you know, it went up 10%. But my bigger question about this whole issue, because you can think about this question I'm going to ask you in a minute. The question I'm going to ask you is, what would you have done if you were the chair of Tesla and Elon had asked for all of these shares, okay? But this is my broader question. It's actually a much deeper question. How much money does one human being need? Like, the guy, is it like the richest guy in the world, the second richest? Who knows? It's him and Bernard Arnault, right?
Well, it's Jeff Bezos. Oh, he's a third.
And Bezos, who knows? Whatever. I don't, like, and so maybe to him it really matters if he's number one.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure
the guy, what's he worth? $100 billion or something? Some ridiculous.
170, those guys are around.
Okay. So let's say instead of having $170 billion, he gets $30 billion more money. I just want to say, like, $3 million is a lot of money. $30 million sets you up for life. I'm talking about 1,000 times that, $30 billion, it barely moves the needle for him. It definitely doesn't change his life. How much money does a human being need that they're prepared to go to war for? It just, there's just something fundamentally wrong with this direction of society.
Well, I think at this point, it's a cock measuring contest here. Who's got the most money? Clearly, you're right. Above a billion, it probably doesn't make a difference to, or even less. So at this level, whether you got 150, 120, 90, 50, makes no difference at all other than saying I'm the richest person in the world. And clearly that makes a difference to him.
No, but my point is he's not just trying to make more money. He's going to war and expending all this mental energy and public reputational damage, which he seems to be okay with, to be fair. Like, I mean, for another $30 billion, the guy's already got all this. Like, it just seems the whole thing to me to be completely crazy, that just people want to accumulate endless amounts of money and are prepared to go to this effort to do it. What would you do if he came and said, I'm only going to do this job for the next 5 years, if you give me another $40 billion, effectively of shareholder money, right? If I build value, like, wouldn't you have to agree? If you don't agree, you're out.
Yep.
And your entire wealth, whatever, however much money you've made, doesn't matter. Your entire wealth is built on having that job. Yep. Surely you're not telling me that you would have said no in that situation.
I think this timing is so delicious that you've got Tesla challenging, trying to get Elon back his $50 billion or $40 billion or whatever it is, like a huge amount of money. At the same time, they've announced this. And if you're a Tesla shareholder, what would be concerning is not so much the profit drop by 50%. It's the underlying, and we've been talking, I wrote an article about this probably 3 years ago. Again, at the time, it was probably a bit more insightful, but now everybody thinks, oh, God, that's obvious. But you've got Tesla's great benefit was it had that great, amazing vertical. So it made the cars, didn't have to use showroom, it used its own showrooms, didn't have to pay dealers all this money. It was beautifully integrated.
It was the first direct-to-consumer car business, exactly. Basically.
Had these huge margins, had margins of like 3x other car companies. So there was a genuine, it got over that production hell and was able to build these cars really efficiently, gigafactories everywhere. It still felt super overvalued, but what you could see coming was a wave of competition. And we thought the wave of competition was coming from the BMWs and the GMs. And there is that, there's no doubt. But the big one has been the BYDs and some of the electric car companies. Yeah. Polestar less so, because Polestar's got its own issues. That's dropped precipitously as well, owned by Geely and the Volvo sort of business. But
BYD, Volkswagen is going to be competing aggressively. But Volkswagen, the world's biggest car company. Like,
well, Toyota's the world's biggest car company, but yeah, and they're coming as well.
Sales is Volkswagen?
I think by everything Toyota is.
Okay. I mean, but the Japanese are miles behind on electric cars.
Well, the Japanese taking the different... Years behind. They're trying to do that different battery, the totally different type of battery.
Whatever.
If it works.
They're years behind.
Yeah, but they are. They bet on hybrids, didn't they? So, which, funnily enough, hybrids have also come back. I love electric cars, but the sort of hybrid, which is electric petrol car, have also made a resurgence in the last sort of year. So Tesla's got a huge competition. So they've dropped their prices multiple times. So the margin's been smashed. The margin's gone from like being triple everybody else to lower than other companies. And a fascinating comparison, if you look at GM announced a 25% increase in net income last quarter. And I think GM's now making a couple of billion a year. Yeah, so they made $3 billion in net income last quarter. So they're making about $12 billion a year. So GM's trading on a multiple of about 6x profit. And Tesla's trading on a multiple about 33, 34, 35 times, depending on what share price sits at. If Tesla, and obviously Tesla's shrinking, GE grow, albeit on combustion, largely on combustion sales. But if you gave Tesla GE's multiple, which isn't hugely outrageous, Tesla would be a sub $50 billion business. So when you look at that, and now you look at this whole Elon Musk compensation thing. So go back in time and they basically said, Tesla was a small business and they effectively gave, if you look at Black's goals, they gave him options worth about $2.3 billion at the time. And that $2.3 billion grew to $55 billion sort of as...
You say it was a small business, but it was still worth billions of dollars.
Yeah, but nothing like what it is. It's like a... No, it was a $30, $40 billion valuation, but it grew to like $700 billion, or grew to a trillion, I think, at one point. So Elon briefly got his $55 billion, got stripped later on, but got $55 billion. But now Tesla could be worth less than $55 billion. So you could have, Robin Denham could have, and listen, I don't want to blame her because she was part of a board. They all decided it. She was the sort of most senior person on the board, but clearly it wasn't her call.
She was not the person closest to Elon on that board. No, in fact, she wouldn't even be in the top three people closest to Elon.
His brother's on the board and all sorts of...
And people have got much longer and deeper relationships with Elon on that board than she does.
Although she has benefited to the tune of like $700 million from it. So she's certainly been...
Well, that's my point. Yeah. That's my point. Nobody can stand in front and stop a founder effectively in complete control of this business from doing stuff like this. Because fundamentally, the thing I do not believe for a second...
So that is the job of the board. You have a fiduciary duty to all shareholders.
Yes, I agree. And when we can go and put like robots and computers as directors of companies, then we'll be able to stop things like this. But like, unfortunately, it's human beings and it's, you know, enormous wealth and relationships and whatever else.
You're saying this like this happens all the time. I don't recall anybody having paid more than sort of a couple of $100 million. This is $55 billion. This is 1,000 times more than what anybody else has been paid in the history of commerce. To say this is the usual thing is wrong.
That's why I'm saying to you, what would you have done?
I would have resigned from the board. I would absolutely.
Would you?
Yeah.
What about your hundreds of millions of dollars?
Well, I think in the next few years, when Tesla goes down to sort of sub $100 billion, and if Elon does get this money and he's able to sell, he's already sold $22 billion worth of shares. I'm not sure if it's the direct shares or other shares, but if it turns out that Tesla's given effectively the entire value of the business to the CEO, who was the biggest shareholder, that is borderline criminal. And again, I want to blame Robin for this because the whole board did it and she was just the mouthpiece. But every person on that board is equally culpable in paying the founder CEO this extraordinary sum of money for a business that could end up back where it started.
All right, but it's not criminal. What you're saying is...
Directors have fiduciary obligations that could be criminal. Absolutely. Insolvent trading is criminal.
This is why I push it back to this question. So you've got someone who comes and they've told you, I'm not going to stick around and run this company if I don't get this. By the way, that's the thing I think is least true. In my view, I mean, Elon is an unpredictable guy.
Yeah.
But you've got $100 million or $50 100%. Billion. Did I say billion? Yeah, 50 yeah. billion. Where are you going?
Yeah,
where exactly. are you going? To SpaceX? You're doing that at the same time. To X? You're doing that at the same time. To your family? I mean, give me a break. That seems like the last place he wants to be. And so, like, I just don't think any of it was true that 100%. He was going to leave. But I do think that he would have ejected a director that stood in the way of that, unless they all unified to stand in the way. And this is why I don't blame Robin Denholm for this. Because she was not and is not one of the directors that's especially close to Elon. And I just don't think it's plausible that these people who have got these relationships would have agreed to unite and stand in the way of him doing it. And so what would have had to happen is what you said, which is I resign from the board and give up all my money. And maybe you would do that. And, you know, I'm not saying that you wouldn't. In fact, you might. But almost no one would actually do that. And so I'm not saying it's right or okay. What I'm saying is it's not a surprise. I don't think it's right and okay, if I'm just going to put it out there. But I don't think it's a surprise. I think it's completely predictable that this is how the board has behaved.
I think that's a fair summary. I'm on a couple of – actually on a number of boards, but sort of in terms of independent companies, only a handful. And the thing that I'm – probably most sensitive about, I'm not sure what you, I'm just going to get your views on this, but founders taking salaries, I hate it. Obviously, I think founders should get some sort of salary because you've got to afford to eat. But when founders start taking salaries of more than, call it a couple of hundred K, that starts absolutely, I think for most investors, it drives them wild. Because if you've raised $500,000 and you're paying yourself $300,000, it's just taking money out of one pocket and putting in the other. I hate it. And this is just like that times a million. but the thing that I'm super sensitive about is that.
Depends how long they've been a founder for. It depends. Like if they've been doing it for 10 years, then I think that you need to start paying them commercial salaries, frankly.
No, I disagree. I don't think it's based on 10 years, but I think it's based on the size of the business. If you've been there 10 years and the business is doing billions of dollars and hundreds of millions of dollars in profit, then sure. Yeah, that becomes different. The business is still small in 10 years' time. I don't think you should be paying the CEO a lot. I think the CEO... Usually we have a lot of equity, and maybe it's different if they don't have equity, but every founder's should have a degree of equity. And I don't see why they should be getting my pay is still, I'll be the halfway down in the luxury escapes pay scale, probably.
All right, but that's you. And I look,
I don't think that's, don't entirely, I think that's fairly common.
Entirely agree with your view on this. So I agree with your view that is, if the business is still little and whatever, then what you need to pay founders is enough for them to actually live a life, but not like big salaries, and probably you're going to pay them less than they would earn elsewhere, because what they're getting in return is a whole lot of stuff that founders get. Some of it's wealth creation opportunity, and some of it's other stuff that's great, right? But I do think where a business has grown over time, 10, 15 years, and is a real business, tens of millions of dollars of revenue or hundreds of millions or whatever it might be, and the founder is still running it, I think it's wrong to have the attitude, which is, well, they're so exposed with their equity that we don't have to pay them properly on a day-to-day basis. And the reason I think it's wrong is because the ability of the founder to liquidate that equity and get access to that money is quite limited. And so what they're relying on a day-to-day basis is the salary that you're paying them. And actually, you don't really, if you're on the board, you don't really want the founder to be selling down their equity. It's such a negative signal, and like, especially in a private space. And so I've got no issue with paying founders properly. I do have an issue with founders claiming that unless you pay them exorbitantly, they're not going to stick around and keep growing their business. I don't think it's true generally, but even more than that, I just don't think it's right. I don't think it's right. But I do think, can I say one more thing about this? Because look, I don't think it's a black and white issue. Like if the board really did believe that Elon would walk with that $2 billion of options, which became 40, but let's call it two, okay? Then I don't think it's an easy decision to just say don't pay him and let him walk away, because that would be severely destructive for shareholder value.
The extreme example you gave, I don't think everybody was going to agree with that. I think where it becomes more challenge, and where I disagree with you, is company's 10 years old, it's making some money, not maybe it's not making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, it's making some money, and the CEO is getting paid, call it, so the CEO is getting paid 200 grand a year, which I think could be the call it, the inverted commas founder's salary, and arguably the market price is, call it, $1 million a year, and you say, oh, the founder should be able to get close to market value. I'd argue, in a sense, the founder's got a lot of equity, and a business has been going for 10 or 15 years, that business should have either been paying dividends or probably done some sort of secondary, enough that that founder isn't desolate and can afford to do stuff. So I'm being, in my view, being a founder is a privilege, and you get lots of great things being a founder. You're associated with the business, and you talked about a couple of weeks ago, your identity's bound up in the business, and when a business is going well, that's hugely positive. So I think you get a lot of soft benefits of being a founder. And I think the quid pro quo is you should take a lower than market salary. And that the benefits you get is dividends and secondary and all that, and the whole sort of halo effect of being a founder. And obviously, when you get to Elon, this is just batshit crazy stuff that he's asking for so much money. Like, even the $2.3 billion Black Skulls valuation is ridiculous. Like, he doesn't need any of it. He should be working for a dollar like Jeff Bezos and James Packer did. He doesn't need any salary.
What if you really thought he was going to leave?
I think he'd take that chance. I don't think he can be beholden to somebody like that. As good as he is, I don't think he can be beholden.
So I think that's the fundamental question. Because it's easy for me to sit here and say, it's obvious he wasn't going to leave.
No.
But nothing is obvious with this guy. Like, can you imagine what it would be like interacting with him as a board? Like, it would not be a simple experience. And so if you really did believe that he was going to leave, unless you paid him $2 billion of options, and you have a business that's worth, I don't know what it was worth at the time, a few tens of billions of dollars probably.
Yeah, it's 50, 60.
And you think, he wants to go and build this business to a $1 trillion valuation. And like, all right, it's easy to say now in retrospect, he's not going to get there. But by the way, some people probably still think he is, but I don't think that's no chance. And so, but like, you believe that at the time, and he can make you believe anything, I think. Like, I think that it's not such an easy decision in that moment. I will say I have huge issues with the court intervening in this way and making this finding. I don't think it's any of a court's business. This was brought by shareholders who felt aggrieved.
One small shareholder.
Effectively, it was brought by a lawyer, we could say, and who was running this case. And I just don't think it's the role of the courts to be making decisions about this. You've got a board, And I think
to clarify, what the court found was board's decisions should almost always hold. But in this case, the board was so conflicted, and you got Robin's $700 million, you got the fact that it's Elon's brother, you got all this sort of stuff that meant that the board were no longer independent and the shareholders were not properly informed. And that was why the Delaware Chancery Court, and the judge who was a very good judge, one of the most respected corporate judges in the US, this wasn't some two-bit Donald Trump appointment, and this is a genuine judge, and she made a finding that I think is defensible. I have issues with second-guessing directors as well, but I don't think this was a terrible finding. I think it was arguable, absolutely arguable. I think that, just going back to the commercialities of it, and you listen to the All In guys, are all Elon's mates, and they spend hours defending him and defending it. I think the challenge with the way it's been worked is, if you were to go to Elon, here's your massive options payout. If you can generate value, that's great. I think that what they didn't do, and we talked about this, I think last week or the week before, is they should have had a lockup on it. They should say, we'll give you $55 billion and locked up for 20 years or 15 years. Because the problem is they didn't lock it up. So it's what effectively happened is the valuation hit $1 trillion. He could have sold them all. Valuation goes back to zero and he's kept his money. So it needed to be locked up for a huge period of time if you want to, and that way you keep him involved as well for 20 years, if that's what the goal was.
I think that's a good point. I think, you know, I just get the feeling that he's a person who's very hard to read. He may not even know what his own decision is going to be from one minute to the next. I think it would be even harder to say no to. And so, you know, I think that is a very unique situation, but my overarching view, if you said to me, summarize all of your thoughts just with an overarching view, it would be, I think the court should stay out of it, but I don't think anybody should get paid $40 billion for anything. That would be my general view.
I think actually James Murdoch's on this board as well from memory, so it's a pretty high level board we've got here. But I think the only thing you can
even
do is...
James Murdoch can't say no to Elon. I wonder if Rupert Murdoch could say no. I think Rupert Murdoch could say no to Elon. Yeah.
I think you had to resign. I think that the only real option for directors then was to resign, because I agree. I don't think you can say no to him because he gets rid of you. So I think that what you had to do was resign at the time and cop it. I understand $700 million to Robin, it's hard to say no to that. But I think in the fullness of time, these directors will be looked upon very unfavorably by history, especially if Tesla drops to 10, 20 billion, which it might very well do if this continues.
I mean, my prediction of this industry, and I'm not an insider in this industry in any way, but when I just look at it from kind of like geopolitics and macro, I think the Japanese will catch up. It will take them 5 years. They'll catch up. The Koreans are doing a great job in electric vehicles.
He has got great.
The Chinese, look, my personal view I know you share is that like the Chinese economy is not fantastic. And I think there's a possibility that China has passed its peak as a,
absolutely.
I don't know what you call it.
Yeah. Power.
As a country. As a power, exactly.
Well, and I think so for this, I'm not sure that in this iteration of China, it might come back in
next
number of years.
For sure. And so I think, you know, BYD is not, I don't think in 10 years' time, BYD is going to be the global dominator. That's my personal view. And I think that the Volkswagen group, so I think the Volkswagen group, the Japanese and the Koreans will be really strong. The Indians are the unknown factor. And I think that like Americans, there is still something very special about Americans in terms of their innovation and just their ability to stay on top. You know, I looked at a graph of GDP, global share of GDP, and everyone talks about America as a declining power, but America's share of GDP in 2023 is the same as it was globally in 2006. It hasn't fallen at all. It went down and it went back up. What's fallen is Japan. Obviously, what's risen is China. Europe and the UK have been on a slide. India is up now, pretty much level pegging with Japan, which is almost hard to believe. But the US has the same share of global GDP as it did in 2006. It's not that's not the mark of a declining power.
Yeah, that's the trope on the US, and there's people have pointed to that. The argument against that is the way the US have achieved that is through extraordinary debt creation. And if you look at the amount of debt, it's gone by like 15 trillion to 100 trillion or something. And look at the percentage of debt to GDP, it's skyrocketed. So yeah, the GDP is maintained. In many cases, the US is doing a great job. But if you look at the debt levels, there's a real argument this is a bankrupt country that is surviving on the good nature of its creditors.
Well, when you say good nature, its biggest creditor is China. And like, how do you think it plays out if China comes knocking on the door with the debt collection agency saying, pay back our money? They'll think they might find a few aircraft carriers and other things on their doorstep. So China can't collect on their debt in a hostile way.
The issue is not necessarily the historical debt. The issue is the US still runs a huge deficit and has to keep funding
it. They do.
Eventually, the bond vigilantes come back and they can't sell. The US has to be paying more and more interest on its debt because it's less and less quality of lender. And suddenly, or borrower, I should say, and suddenly they simply can't afford to pay back. So that's the real risk on the US. Debt to GDP is getting to incredibly concerning levels.
It's possible, but I think those points are good. My broader point is, you called it, there's a trope of the GDP trope. It's not a declining empire. But I think the real tropes are the US is a declining empire, and people make these comments like just in passing because of particular things that the US does, which I don't think that they're smart, but they make these in passing, ignoring the fact that the US is still by far the largest economy in the world. It hasn't fallen in terms of GDP. Yes, it's debt-fueled. It still has by far the biggest military and spends the most money by a significant amount each year on its military. Like, I think no empire lasts forever, but I think, these alarmists that say, like, the end is nigh for the US, I don't think it's nigh, is my view. I think the biggest risk that the US has is, they've been through one civil war historically, and I think the biggest risk they have is internal problems much more than external problems. And I think if they don't start cleaning up some of the people now that are running through the streets chanting death to the USA, who are American citizens in their own cities, I think that's the kind of thing that causes real problems with the US.
When that comes from a couple of current issues, but also comes from the huge inequality of wealth that's resulted from this period of debt-funded inflation, essentially. And the rich have gotten a lot richer, and we'll talk about this next week more, but the rich have gotten a lot richer, and the poor have gotten a lot poorer, and the middle class have gotten poorer. This is the first time in generation, possibly first time ever in the US, where children are less wealthy than their parents were at the same age. We've seen a backwards progression in the US.
All right, but the people yelling death to the USA are on Ivy League college campuses. This is not like, so, I take your point and I agree, like, one of the major issues that has caused revolutions throughout history has been extreme income and wealth disparity, and eventually the poor people go and pick up, pitchforks or guns, and you end up with a civil war and a revolution. But at the moment, I think the US has got some bigger problems to solve, and I very much believe the external threats to the US today are not existential threats to the US, but they, at various periods of time, have faced internal existential threats. The worst was the Civil War, but it wasn't the only one. And I think that it doesn't look like there's a civil war that's imminent in the US, but there's some real problems of divisiveness in the US that are going to need to be solved.
That's fair. I think if you look at China, it's possibly were. It's hard because China's so opaque. There's debt at local government level. There's these insolvent banks. There's insolvent construction companies everywhere. It's really hard to know, but I think China actually looks worse than US, if that's possible. So it's almost like it's a worse off. Who hits the bottom first? I think it's probably China.
We called China going backwards this year. I think we were real contrarians in making that call.
Yeah.
We called interest rates not going down.
I think you actually called them going up, which is looking more and more right every day.
So I think that was definitely a contrarian call. I would give us both credit for that, because the general sentiment was that they'd be going down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's early. It's only, April? But I think that there's been some surprises in terms of what the world was expecting so far this year.
Well, the world is, let's frankly, stupid. Remember when we had inflation? We had inflation 2 years ago, and it was clear as day that this was a real problem. And everybody said it was transitory. Don't worry about it. Let's keep interest rates at zero.
Modern don't monetary worry. Theory.
Yeah. I mean, interest rates below zero in Switzerland. Like, it was just insane, the period we lived through. And I guess we come back to an Austrian-style school of economics where your view was interest rates would go up. My view was they should go up, but I don't know if the RBA or the Fed have the gumption to do it. But it's looking more and more likely, certainly in Australia, that they could very well be going up. And they should be. I've been saying this, as you know, incessantly for a year. Interest rates are at least 100 basis points too low, probably higher based on the current inflation rate. The only thing we can say about Australia versus the US is at least Australia is running what appears to be a budget surplus, courtesy of iron ore profits and that
mining.
Sort of stuff. Mining profits. Whereas the US still runs these huge deficits. So whilst the US is a bit more responsible monetary-wise, their fiscal policy is like off the charts, batshit crazy. So, and you've got special interest groups pushing for everything. So they're funding multiple wars and all this stuff. So US has got those sort of issues at the fiscal level, which is clearly leading to that sticky inflation. Australia at least doesn't have as much.
We might not have any interest rate rises if Trump is elected and he gets his way of changing the law so that he has control over interest rate changes at the Federal Reserve and can fire the head of the Federal Reserve. So, you know, the world is a slightly too interesting place to be a part of at the moment. You know, there's this myth of the Chinese saying, curse, may you live in interesting times. No one I've ever spoken to that speaks Chinese natively has ever come across that as a curse. But in the West, we've always said there's a curse that the Chinese have, which is may you live in interesting times. Yeah. I think the times are a bit too interesting at the moment.
Very interesting times. On that note, let's say goodbye. It's been a fascinating episode this week again. Thanks to Keelan for sitting through it. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We will be back next week with news and views from Australia's greatest executive chairman and myself.
Thank you for listening to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir. If you want to submit a question for the show, please send a voice recording to Adam J. Schwab at Instagram. Today's show was produced by Mike Liberale. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. Please give us a rating and don't forget to tell your friends. We'll be back next week for our weekly analysis of all things growth and tech.